From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on Tuesday, November 22nd, in a federal courtroom in Sherman, Texas. And before we get to that story, a brief note. Some listeners have emailed or tweeted at me, assuming we were going to be talking today about our investigative reporting series on the lack of diversity on local teaching staffs. And I'm glad you asked. We're setting aside this Friday for that conversation, both hours, but we're going to be doing it a little bit differently. All week long, we're airing our year-long investigation into the lack of diversity in local teaching. The first report aired this morning. You can find it online now at WXXINews.org. You'll also find an interactive map of Monroe County so you can search for your own school district. What's the student diversity? And how does teacher diversity stack up? Some of the numbers could surprise you. In Monroe County, there are 5 school districts that don't employ a single African-American teacher. There are several more districts that employ just one. So I hope you'll check out the map and the pieces online and that you'll share them. If you're in the Finger Lakes, we also have information stacked in a document there for you. It's a tall challenge dealing with this issue, and every morning this week at 6:45 and 8:45 on Morning Edition, you're going to hear new reports on the series. You'll also hear them during All Things Considered at 4:44 in the afternoon. Then, this Friday, we're doing the talk show live at the Little Theater, live audience, both hours on this subject, and that means that you can join us. I hope you will. We think it's going to be a powerful way to end the week of reporting. It's free to attend. We think we have enough seats for anyone who wants to attend. So, Friday, Little Theater, Connections Live. See you there. Now, about today's connections. As I mentioned, our connection this hour was made on Tuesday, November 22nd, in that federal courtroom in Texas. U.S. District Court Judge Amos Mazant II decided to block an Obama administration policy that would have given more workers overtime starting this month, or at least made them eligible. That policy had sparked all kinds of debate and legal challenge. Opponents said it would have increased government costs by tens of millions of dollars for states that were already struggling, while forcing private companies to pay even more, and that, critics argued, would have led to widespread layoffs. The Obama administration has argued that too many workers are unprotected. Their employers can push them into many extra hours without having to pay for it. And government statistics show that just 7% of full-time salaried workers have overtime protections, compared to 62% in 1975. First up this hour, we want to fully understand what this means for workers. And beyond that, there's plenty to talk about when it comes to issues facing workers at this particular moment in American history. Donald Trump campaigned on being the hero of the working class. Harold Meyerson, the executive editor of the American Prospect, wrote a piece titled, "Donald Trump Can Kill the American Union." Meyerson says his election is, quote, an extinction-level event for American labor. Trump's supporters counter that he can save jobs and create millions more, like he's promised, and that he will be a great friend to workers. Well, let's talk about all of that and more. My guests for the hour include Beth Cordello, who is the chair of labor and employment practice at Polano & Farrow. That's a law firm here in Rochester. Beth, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Jesse Lenny's here, upstate political director of the Working Families Party. Jesse, always nice to see you.
Nice to see you.
Carly Fox is here from the Worker Justice Center. Carly, welcome to you.
Thanks, Evan.
And Paul Hippolyte is here. He's the regional political organizer for New York State United Teachers. Paul's here from NYSET. Welcome to you as well.
Thank you, Evan.
I want to start with Jesse Lenny just for sort of that broad view here when it comes to, you know, what the most pressing issue. I mean, we're going to kind of start with overtime, but I don't know if what's number one on your list. As a WFP, as an organizer, thinking about workers, thinking about the next administration, what's your primary concern, Jesse?
Our primary concern this year is that we think, given the risk to all workers, that we need New York State to become a bulwark against Trumpism, protect the people who could lose their health insurance if and when Obamacare is repealed and how it's repealed, protect Social Security, and millions of people are on Social Security. Sort of broader issues that impact everyone.
Okay. Paul, number one issue for you?
I think the Constitutional Convention is an issue that's coming up in 2017. That's going to be a very important one, particularly for workers and pensions and safe retirement. So that's going to be probably number one if you're talking about statewide for issues that we have.
Okay. Carly Fox?
Extension of what Jesse's saying, that we'd like to see Cuomo, Governor Cuomo, really set New York's state aside and in light nationally to be pro-immigrant and really create a set of laws that protect immigrant workers, extend basic rights such as the right to drive legally, and to stop collaboration with local law enforcement that results in deportations.
Okay. Well, let me ask Beth Cordello from Polano & Farrow to help lead us off on the question on this overtime issue, because we've had a lot of listener questions on it, first of all. I've done as much reading and background as I could on this. What's the short version of what this means right now for workers, Beth?
Right. So the federal minimum salary was set to increase from about $23,000 to $47,000. It's a huge increase. New York State's minimum salary currently as of today is $35,000. So even in New York State, even though we did more than the federal minimum, it was a significant increase. That federal judge, who, by the way, was appointed by President Obama, agreed with the 21 states and the business organizations that said that the Department of Labor exceeded its regulatory authority in issuing such a dramatic increase and indexing it for automatic increases in the years going forward. The judge agreed that they will probably succeed and put an injunction on that law going into effect. It was supposed to go into effect December 1st. The Department of Labor has since appealed to the Fifth Circuit. That's a traditionally conservative court, and they've asked for an expedited hearing on this matter. So no word yet on when a final decision will be rendered, though.
Just from a legal analysis perspective, were you surprised by what the judge decided?
I was very surprised.
You were?
Yes. With the preliminary injunction, I was surprised that would be done in the 11th hour, so to speak. This has been surprising times in these past few months with the election and everything that's changed. Meanwhile, in the state of New York in October, the New York State Department of Labor has also proposed to increase the minimum salary. There wasn't much fanfare about it at the time because it was so eclipsed by the federal law, but that goes into effect at the end of the month. And so the minimum salary will increase, not as drastically as what the federal law wanted, but it will increase.
And Beth, forgive my ignorance, but I know that you have represented workers. You've represented essentially all sides in the field of working, labor, and I'm wondering if you've repped workers who've come to you and said, look, I'm getting pushed around. This is not fair. I'm working so many extra hours. What's the recourse? Does that happen now, and do you expect more of that with this?
It happens quite a bit where more unscrupulous employers will misclassify someone who should be hourly and getting overtime for hours worked over 40 in a work week in order to squeeze them. This typically happens in middle management and retail and restaurants, but in all sorts of businesses. But then on the other side, not talking about, the Walmarts and the McDonald's and these, huge corporate Goliaths, but the mid to small size businesses are also struggling with this change because with that dramatic increase in salary, they're looking at either laying off workers or reducing hours. And so it's tough all around. I don't know that the increase should have been as drastic as it was. I don't think we'd be here today with what we're looking at, with what's pending in the federal court. But it's a difficult issue all the way around, but it certainly needs to be addressed. There's an epidemic of working poor in this country. And I think the Department of Labor's intent was good in trying to address that. If you're working full time, you shouldn't be living in poverty. I think they possibly went just a little too far, though, and were just a little too ambitious.
All right. In a second, I'm going to ask Jesse to follow up on some of this stuff here. But just two quick points here, Beth. I think sometimes when it comes to looking at a ruling like this, it's easy to speak a little overly generalized or overly monolithically. In other words,
yeah,
we could say, oh, boy, workers are just, getting the short end of it. Or we could say employers would have been treated unfairly under this ruling. Is it possible that it's both? Is it possible that there are a lot of American workers who are working many hours past 40, the system is essentially manipulated against them, and employers are taking advantage? Is it also possible that some employers were telling the truth here, that they would have probably had to lay off people, that this would have been a squeeze for them, for some but not all? Is it somewhere in the middle?
That's exactly right. And what people aren't understanding, too, with the increases to the minimum wage and the increases to salary, it's not just these, the cost of the entry-level workers, but it's what some call compression. For example, with the increase of minimum wage to $15 an hour, you have all of these other workers who've worked for years to get up to $15 an hour, and now entry-level workers are getting that, and they're saying, wait a minute, well, I should be getting a raise too, and that's hard to argue against. And so I've been working with businesses and trying to restructure them organizationally and with their budget in trying to accommodate all of this. And so it's difficult on both sides, but I believe that most want a good result for their workers. And of course, workers want to be paid fairly and rightly so.
Absolutely. Okay, Jesse, when it comes to the way we heard 21 states and private companies saying that this kind of rule is going to put an unfair squeeze on them, Are you, given your work and your background, is your default mode to say, come on, or do you think that there's something to it?
I mean, I think American employers have gotten away with very low-paid salaried workers working a lot of hours uncompensated and or misclassifying workers who shouldn't be exempt from overtime laws. And so, you know, I think in this country, people want to get paid for the work they do. And if you're in business, and I think most small businesses and most employers want to pay people for the work they do, but then the law should reflect that. Maybe there's a transition period that could have been. I mean, to be honest, like given the election, you know, this is an academic debate, but maybe.
In other words, we're not going back in a different direction.
I mean, we could in New York State, but not in the federal level. But some sort of transition. I mean, we've been an advocate for indexing minimum wage forever, which would be much easier for small businesses to plan ahead for smaller increases rather than every 10 years having a huge fight over it and then hitting them with big increases, at least big in their mind. But politics matters and elections matter. And
this is one of those moments when I've heard you many times say elections matter.
Yeah, yeah. I listened to the Monday show before the election after on Wednesday, and
it's like a different world.
There are consequences,
isn't it? Yes. Well, really, actually, I go back and read articles written for the election. It feels like a different world. But when you say elections have consequences, this is one of those times, and therefore, in other words, we can talk about overtime, but you don't expect change to go back in the direction that the Obama administration was pushing.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, I think people who believe in the policies that we believe in are going to be on defense, at least for a few years. If there's an opportunity to, in New York State, to do it a little smarter where we can transition it in, employers can get used to it. I mean, we don't, under any administration, we don't want to be in a situation where you've got millions of people unemployed and then you've got millions of people working 60 hours a week uncompensated work. And that just doesn't make sense. If there are people out there who want to work, they should do that work. That work should be available to them.
All right, listeners, if you have any questions about these subjects, whether it's overtime or as we transition to talk about some of these other issues, you can call the program. It's toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. The short answer, Beth Cordello, is Jesse's probably right. We're not, with the new Trump administration, we're not going back in a direction of that higher number in terms of overtime. That we probably won't see more protections for overtime for workers for at least a while now. You agree?
I agree. Well, Trump hasn't made this particular issue a priority. It seems that other issues have been priorities, and I wonder, because he campaigned on the working man's guy premise.
You're not saying that people campaign on things and then govern differently, are you?
Maybe I'm just hopeful.
Yeah, okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about the campaign here, because Harold Meyerson, who is the executive director of the American Prospect, and he, executive editor, I should say, wrote a piece in the Washington Post and said that Donald Trump's election could be an extinction-level event for American labor. And he pointed some things out in that Washington Post piece. First of all, Trump won Ohio's union vote, 54-42. Paul went to school in Ohio. I'm from Ohio, went to school in Ohio. Beth's from Ohio. Spent a lot of time there. We saw a lot, especially when you drive through more rural counties. You saw,
yes.
You were telling before the hour began, you would drive on the way to here and there, so you're not at all surprised that this result
right.
in Ohio.
Well, I was sharing with you, Evan, that I grew up in a traditionally blue part of the state where there are a lot of union workers, and I went home to Ohio in September and October, and it was just Trump sign after Trump sign, and I'd never seen that in my life during a presidential election.
I've spoken to people who have described union meetings in which they said half the room walks out when they pull out Clinton signs. Jesse Lenny, 54-42, Trump wins Ohio's union vote. I mean, did you ever expect you'd see that?
No, I didn't. I thought we would lose Ohio, but I was particularly disappointed in Pennsylvania. But anecdotally, I talked to an iron worker in Ohio one of the weekends before the election, and I was struck by how much he knew the risks to his employment and to his union, but still, you know, wasn't sure what he was going to do. And I had walked away from his house thinking he's going to do the right thing, but clearly some of the folks didn't. So I think people are just frustrated with decades of not seeing themselves in the conversation, in the political conversation in both parties. And you know, made, and we should keep in mind that Hillary Clinton won the popular vote by over 2 million votes, that some of the Rust Belt Five, as they call them, you know, were lost by tens of thousands of votes, very, very small numbers. But, you know, it's meaningful what those what voters decided to do in those states. And I think it was just out of some frustration.
Yeah, 12,000 in Michigan, 27,000 in Wisconsin. Those are not big margins when you look at the total number of voters, but those are not states the Democrats thought they really... 6 weeks ago, 8 weeks ago, 10 weeks ago, there's no way they thought they could even lose those states. And, you know, Hillary Clinton was campaigning in Texas and Georgia and not going to the Rust Belt. So, Jesse, and then I'll broaden it out here. Let me just ask you a follow-up to this. Meyerson points out something else here that I think is important. He writes that a half century ago, more than a third of those Rust Belt workers were unionized. And that's not the case today. Nationally, about 7% of private sector workers are union members. And so, you know, you've got union membership declining. And how do voters react? In the Rust Belt, they don't vote for the party that has claimed to be on the side of workers for decades. They voted for Trump. They voted for Republicans on their legislatures and their state leadership. How do you explain that? Is this a case now where Democrats have drifted from actual policy that is better representing union workers and American workers, whether they're unionized or not?
Yeah, I think one thing I would add to that is that based on the two candidates that were running, this election was pretty toxic, which normally turns off voters and lowers turnout. And you know, there were some people who thought that by ginning up fear of the other side, people would vote out of fear. But clearly, turnout was very low among traditional Democratic supporters, including union members and working class people and people of color. And I watched all the debates, and every time Hillary broke through and had a few seconds to talk about something positive, you know, if we were able to make the election about the things, the policies that Clinton was talking about, I think we would have done a lot better. But there was just so much negative campaigning. And, you know, part of that was a strategy. Part of it was just the nature of this particular campaign.
But let me remind listeners, you were on this show along with Alex White from the Green Party, some others. You have consistently said that you think the best way to advance the cause of working Americans is not to break off and go with the Green Party or a different party. It's to work within the Democratic Party and push them in the direction of those policies, to work within the existing system. And do you think, in other words, do you think the Democratic Party for years wasn't pushed in that direction enough in the way that you think would have actually signaled to workers, we are with you?
Yeah, definitely not enough.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I think there would have been, a close election with a Clinton victory would have put us in a position to push the Democrats in a much better direction. Certainly a loss. There's an argument to be made. I mean, to move to a more holistic message that people, everyone can see themselves in. I think that's sort of been our agenda for the past 20 years.
All right, Craig in Rochester, hang on the phone. I'm coming to you, but just let me let Paul and Carly weigh in as well here. Paul, we've been sort of talking about the change in union membership and the way it impacted the election. Anything you want to weigh in there?
Well, I kind of wanted to go back for a little bit. When Jesse was talking about what they were focusing on, I think that there's no question that I think Hillary's people thought the better strategy was to make Trump dangerous and to talk about he was going to be dangerous for international relations. He was going to be dangerous on those fronts and didn't really focus in on the economic message. And I think the one thing that Donald Trump did very well was he focused, laser focused on the economy. Although, I mean, his tweets were everywhere. But when he was actually on the stump, the issues he was talking about, everyone knew that he was saying, I'm on the side of workers. I'm against the TPP. I'm against a lot of this global trade that a lot of American workers feel like it hurt them, and rightly so. So that's, I think he did a good job of focusing on those issues, and she and a lot of the Democrats didn't do as well of a job on that. But I think if the silver lining would be that the workers do want better trade policies. They want protections for the workers. They want a focus on jobs and on the economy. And on that issue, if you are focused on the issues on the Democratic side, I think they have a lot of good points and a good message. So the battle might have been lost, but not necessarily the war.
Okay. Carly?
And I just want to take a step back and just like thinking about what this could mean for workers under Trump. You know, when I hear him speak, I hear him treat workers as a commodity to be negotiated on the free trade market. And he's built his wealth off the backs of workers. I think that's what we're not really talking about. We've seen firsthand what unbridled capitalism does in New York State agricultural industry, with so many exclusions, so many exemptions for workers in that industry. And so we can look at what has happened in that industry to degrade working conditions, and that can be an indication of what's to come in others. Americans opted out of working there, and now we rely heavily on immigrant workers, especially in the dairy industry, one of the most dangerous in the country. Yet there's no oversight of OSHA, and 95% of New York State's dairies have no OSHA oversight. And that leads to immigrant workers, you know, paying the price for these profit-making motives and cost-cutting methods to pay with their lives, really. So Trump sends conflicting messages on so many issues. He says he cares about workers, but then he wants to gut OSHA. And we're terrified about what the consequences will be for workers with if we got out OSHA. Those were really long fought for, hard fought for laws. I'm heading to Baltimore for a National Health and Safety Congress conference tomorrow, and we're really worried. That's the basic human rights are around health and safety for a worker, that they don't have to pay for the profits that their employer has with their lives. And we have really, you know, a system that already is so weak. OSHA is vastly underfunded. And so to think about what could happen if we got OSHA, really the dairy industry is an example of what is to come with the high number of fatalities and worker injuries. And Trump speaks about deregulation. Really, that's, you know, it's about deregulation is a code word for protections. He's taking away protections that we fought for. So we think about
business owners would say, Carly, that yes. Regulations often are onerous and unnecessary.
Uh-huh.
That, you know, yeah. They talk about wanting to grow, right. Wanting to have room to hire more.
That's right.
And we've heard from a number of small business owners on this program since the election who voted overwhelmingly for Trump. And they hear deregulation as growth.
Mm-hmm. So if you replace that with protection of workers, then you're saying that we don't want to protect them, that you are not your commodity, really, to be put in a workplace and put in a vulnerable position where there's no entity that is in place to curb that profit margin and make sure that some of the basic protections are there. So I work with hundreds of dairy workers where there is no government oversight of such a dangerous industry. So there's no trainings for immigrant workers, very little protective equipment. There's no OSHA standards for agriculture. It's paper thin, unlike the construction industry and others that have advocated. And because farmers in our romantic notion of small farms wins every time in our lobby efforts. So we should use the lesson of what's happening in agriculture as a lesson of what to prevent in other industries. We can't go backwards. We can't roll back what has been such an important role in the future. So I just look at Trump is saying another contradiction. He says that he wants to rely on American workers, yet he used guest workers for his resorts,
sure.
And all of that.
And then he talks about tariffs and we can talk about his ties.
He brought in models
as
guest workers. And,
yeah.
And again, agriculture, yeah. And tourism are industries that are being, we are importing hands instead of importing families like we have and have a history of doing. We're importing a set of hands that has no connection. Their children are left back in those other countries of Jamaica, Guatemala, Mexico, and we're bringing them in for a short period of time and then spitting them out. If they get injured, we spit them out. It's that their problem. So I, you know, it's just, it's a, you know, we really need to look at long term what Trump's anti-worker, anti-union platform in the history of the Republican Party, it's the worst worst we've ever seen. So we're lowering the floor for some is going to lower the floor for all.
All right, let me let Beth Cordello respond to some of that. Go ahead, Beth.
Well, I was just going to respond to the point of, you know, from the employer's perspective, it's, you know, often their position that we don't need the government to tell us how to protect our workers and how to pay our workers. And I understand your point, and I agree, and especially the agricultural industry has a lot of carve-outs. There's no doubt about that, and that immigrant workers are often vulnerable and exploited. There's no doubt about that. There is, I'm not for complete deregulation, but there is such a thing as over-regulation, and I think we need to focus on regulating in a smart way that fosters growth of business, but also protects and pays our workers.
All right. Let me go ahead and grab Craig in Rochester, and we've got a number of questions and comments from listeners. Go ahead, Craig.
Hello. Yeah, I'm in high tech, basically. I'm a computer technician. And, you know, the work hours, I've been doing this for 40 years, and the work hours are when they want you to work, of course, but I'm scheduled Monday through Friday, 8 to 5, plus overtime. The problem, what my employer has been doing now, though, is they say, okay, you've got your 40 hours in because you had to work 24 hours straight, so don't come in the rest of the week because they don't want to pay the overtime. The problem I have is you'd become dependent on the overtime, of course. Over the years, my salary now, or my income has dropped to such a level, you know, I haven't had a raise in 15 plus years and things like that. So I'm wondering how legal is them? Are they able to do that? I can't get a second job because I'm required to be available 24 hours a day.
Beth, you want to respond? He's asking how legal is that. Go ahead, Beth.
Well, okay, there's a couple of things there. The first is, you know, you're on an hourly basis or salary?
Salary, well, I think they call it hourly, but it's with overtime. But I get a...
Right.
If I didn't show up, I'd get 40 hours.
Right. Okay. Yeah, so you're non-exempt salaried, meaning you're paid a set amount per week, but you get overtime pay for hours worked over 40 in a work week.
Right.
Right. Which is perfectly legal. And no, they don't have to allow you to work those overtime hours. I mean, if they're going to pay you on a salary basis, they have to pay you that set amount on a weekly basis. Now, restricting your availability when you're not being called in, that's an issue that's also hot on the legal front. It's especially prevalent in restaurants and retail where they tell people, they give them short notice saying, you have to be available to come in on a moment's notice, and that's devastating, for example, working mothers that have to arrange for the care of their children. And so lawmakers are working to address that because it's not fair. It's not fair to you if you're not getting the amount of work you need to be able to have something more set to go get a second job. So as it stands right now, it's legal, but that's certainly something that's on the minds of those who are working to protect workers.
Okay.
Craig, good luck to you. And Paul, you want to jump in? Go ahead.
No, I was going to jump in and say that's one of those regulations that I'm sure businesses would go just crazy over because they would say that it is restricting their ability to grow and their ability to change things on a moment's notice. But that's I think you were absolutely right when you were saying that is protections for workers. If you're going to have a family, if you're going to not just working moms, working dads, working whoever.
That's true.
If Craig wants to go get a second job, he can't get a second job. If he wants to do something on the side, he's restricted. And so all the power is concentrated in the hands of the employer in that case. So
okay. And Jesse and Lenny, what struck me about what he said is, I don't think you can do this case by case, but you can speak at a macro level and say, here's an example of what we would call sort of declining wages. When you haven't gotten a raise in 15 years, you are making less money because of inflation and the cost of living. So 15 years without a raise, and we see that too often. Now, David K. Johnston on this program recently talked about wage growth finally starting to happen at the very end of 8 years under the Obama administration, but it hasn't really been felt yet. You know, what are you seeing, Jesse, when it comes to wages and sort of that stagnation in terms of growth?
The American worker's declining ability to negotiate for itself. I mean, it's when you have when 93% of the American private sector workers are bargaining by themselves, it's tougher to negotiate increases when only 7% of the private sector workforce has the ability to bargain collectively as a group. You know, makes it difficult for 7% to sort of carry the rest. When 25-30% of the private workforce was in a union, the wins that they would win in their contracts would lift all the wages up, because non-union employers would want to keep their employers in par with union wages or close enough. And that sort of industry-wide bargaining on behalf of workers is a lot less now than it was.
And by the way, I just read Elon Musk told CNBC. Did you see what he said? This is brand new to me. I don't think he's been saying this for, I think this is new. What he told CNBC on Friday, Elon Musk said he believes the solution to taking care of human workers who are displaced by automation is creating a presumably government-backed universal basic income. And his quote is, there's a pretty good chance we end up with a universal basic income or something like that due to automation. I'm not sure what else one would do. That's what I think would probably have to happen. In other words, his answer to what do we do about automation is nothing. We can't catch up to it. And that's Elon Musk saying that. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think everyone's for productivity increase. American workers are some of the most productive workers in the world. And it's just a question of do all the benefits of that productivity increases go to, you know, 0.5% of the most of the richest individuals and richest corporations? Or is that productivity increases, is a profit from that productivity increases shared universally in better infrastructure, better education, better healthcare, more opportunities for people? So, you know, guaranteed income would sort of, one, it would do away with a lot of bureaucracy in means testing and determining whether people are deserving. If we just said everybody is deserving, it would sort of mitigate the damages. But the real question here is distribution of the benefits. If people go to work and they can produce more, you know, do their families benefit or do just very few?
All right, we're way late for a break, and I've got four great phone calls to get to in terms of just a diverse range of issues from our listeners. So I want to get to them, and I also want to make sure we talk about, before the end of the hour, some questions about what could be coming down the pike with the Supreme Court when it comes to union dues and organizing and what could be ahead. And our panel is going to talk about that. Paul Hippolyte from New York State United Teachers, Jesse Lenny from the Working Families Party, Carly Fox with the Worker Justice Center, Beth Cordello, who's the chair of Labor and Employment Practice Group at Polano and Farrow in Rochester, and your phone calls next. Coming up in our second hour, our monthly science roundtable looks at evolution and what it means to be human. It's a question that has certainly a scientific lens, but also cultural lenses. What does it mean to be human? How have humans adapted and changed how we get information, think about the natural world, religion, and more? What it means to be human in our monthly science roundtable next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Let's try to work through your phone calls. Garrett in Stanley is next up. Go ahead, Garrett.
Hi, I'm a dairy farmer in Stanley, New York, and I listen to your program a lot, and sometimes I hear stuff like, oh, you know, farm workers aren't trained or, you know, given the proper, you know, voice or choice or even option when training, but it's specifically to OSHA. You know, I have to train all my employees once a year through, you know, hazardous materials, what this looks like. I have to go through all my MSDS sheets. They actually recently changed the name of that, but like I have to let my employees know like what is hazardous on the farm, what they can and cannot do, and when they are handling them, have to provide them with the proper equipment. So I know Carly said like 96% of farms, you know, don't do that. Like all I know is like from my experience, that's absolutely that we need to do that.
Go ahead, Carly.
Is it Garrett?
Garrett, yep.
Yeah.
Garrett,
thanks for those comments, and I appreciate you calling in, and I think it's great that you do. If your farm has less than 11 employees, you do not have to do that, you know, by obligation. And so a couple of years ago, we had two different dairy fatalities on farms with less than 11 workers, and OSHA wasn't allowed to step foot onto those farms to even have any citations. When we get a worker complaining on a farm with less than 11 workers, there's no remedy other than to, you know, have them take some serious risk to go forward. There's no protection if they do from retaliation. But I think, you know, I think there are a lot of farmers out there like you who really care about their workers and do the right thing. And I don't want to get into the nitty-gritty of the good farmer, bad farmer paradigm. What I think is really important is to have some minimum, or I would like more than minimum, but I think we need to, in agriculture, have some sort of government regulation that makes sure that those farmers that aren't doing it are. You know, I heard a farmer say to me, who's actually in a neighboring town of yours, one time, that it shouldn't take OSHA to come in to tell me to put a railing on this, the side of the stairs that go up. I really should be doing that on my own. You know, shame on me for not creating more protections. So it's great that you're doing that. And I'm always, you know, impressed when there are farmers who do it just out of their own, you know, free will. But I really strongly believe that we shouldn't leave it up to the goodwill of someone, because when it's not, it could come down to life or death.
Garrett, go
and
ahead.
I guess your point's valid, and whatever farmer said that, you know, you should be doing it on your own, is, I absolutely agree with that. But I would just be careful when you say, like, 96% of farms, like, a lot of those farms don't have employees at all, you know. So I would just be careful with some of your numbers when you say that. Like, is it 96% of farms with employees or 96% of all farms? Because, you know, the majority of farms still don't really have any employees. It's all family run.
Carly?
Yeah, we don't have exact numbers. That was a reference to the 5,600 dairy farms in New York State. And you're right, so many of them are very small. We estimate that where there's 100 cows or even 50 cows, there is a worker. We bet that they're an immigrant. And so that makes them vulnerable. And sometimes when we think of, you know, workers as family members who are not, they're their own individual human being, you know, then again, it makes them vulnerable to be left up to the goodwill of their employer.
I want to, Jesse, you want to jump in real quick here? Because yeah. I have a follow-up email on this. Go ahead,
just
Jesse.
Real quick. I think that's another thing that I don't think is stressed enough, that regulations set an even playing field between employers who are considerate of these things and employers who might not be. So if you're an employer that's doing something out of the goodness of your heart, you're putting yourself at a disadvantage when the regulations allow other employers to profit off the fact that they're not doing it.
Let me just read Jean's email. She says, I live in an area with dairy farms, and I'm nothing but impressed with the employees of the farm and how the employers feel about their workers. I don't see death and mass injury running rampant, and I can't imagine there's a vast cover-up of such things. If you take the apple industry, for example, certain farm tasks require hand-harvest labor, and I can't imagine the price increase in such a grocery store staple that would happen with heavier regulation. What would you say to that, Carly?
I don't even know where to begin with that. I mean, this is what I do. I eat, sleep, and breathe worker advocacy in the agricultural industry of upstate New York. Every day I hear about worker injustices, violations of the law, employers that get away with it routinely, violations of minimum wage, not even paying the bare minimum, covering up workers' compensation, bringing workers into the doctor's offices and being their interpreter and advocate and filling out their C-3 or never letting them know about workers' comp. I mean, we have an industry that is vastly deregulated and unregulated, and workers pay the price for it. And Americans voted with their feet, as the farmers like to say. If you don't like it, vote with your feet. Well, Americans didn't. They opted out of that industry. And now they say there's no workers and we have to import them. We have guest workers coming in from all over or undocumented people filling these jobs. And that's an indication of the degraded conditions. So I think if you ask a farmer, which most of our media, most of our PR in the farm industry is all farmer related, we have an extremely invisible population, literally where the housing is behind the farmers' homes, deep into the fields of those apple orchards, in decrepit trailers on the dairy farms. And they're not seen, they're not heard. Look, they're not here at this show. Why am I speaking for workers? I'd like workers to be out front and center. The dairy workers are working an average of 72 hours a week, 6 days a week, 12-hour shifts. They don't have a right to a day off, so sometimes they don't even have that. They need to be speaking for themselves about what's happening. And I will repeat, some employers are good. I'm not trying to paint that everything is horrible. I'm just saying that we have an industry that's gone awry, and we need to have more regulation. And under Trump, I only see this getting worse.
Okay, let me get back to the phones. Ken in Rochester. Go ahead, Ken.
Yes, I have a comment on the middleman getting squeezed with the wage, minimum wage increase. And that is, I see that a lot of money comes into existence through the Federal Reserve and the borrowing of money by our government. Like when the banks get bailed out, like instead of allowing the banks to fail, they'll get bailed out in the Uber wealthy, like the CEOs will get bonuses of like mil- in the tens of millions. So money comes into the economy on that very high end, and they get to use it before the prices go up. And then in the bottom end of the economy, when people don't have a job and they don't make nearly enough, they can get housing subsidies or food stamps. And I think a lot of that comes from that money as well. So the people who are working enough to be able to sustain themselves, or maybe small business owners, you know, they don't get any of that uber wealthy money at the top, nor the money that comes into the economy from the bottom. So prices go up, they get squeezed, and then the person at the bottom who's just barely working feels, of course, you know, they should be making more money because now they can't afford stuff either. And what's happening is, I think we're saying that businesses should pay more, but that's just shuffling money around the bottom of the economy.
Ken, let me just ask you a quick question, though, Ken. Because I know part of your phone call, you let our call screener know that you think this is actually why union people voted for Trump. Is that right?
Oh, sorry. That's a separate comment. I'll get to it. Sorry. So jobs were going out of union did fight for, you know, workers' rights and higher pay. And then jobs started going out of the country with NAFTA and CAFTA, and people were afraid about TPP. So I think because of those things, that's why people maybe who were union said, okay, I'll vote for Trump because he wants to rip up these free trade agreements that don't protect the American workers. You know, so they voted for, you know, a lot of them voted for Trump.
All right, Ken, let me just jump in and say, I've heard a lot of what Ken is saying in a number of different places. And Jesse Lenny from the Working Families Party, Ken mentions the CEOs at the top. He mentions the bailouts. And we have had national writers on this program saying the fact that we didn't see anybody frog marched from Wall Street during the Obama presidency was a failure that helped set up Trump. Then, in other words, it was a signal that everybody's going right now, well, this is the richest cabinet in history that Trump is putting together. And the snarky response is, oh, yes, under the Obama administration, those White House fat cats were really punished for their misdeeds. I think that's essentially what Ken is saying here, is that union voters didn't really feel that the Democratic Party, maybe anybody, forget any party, was representing them, that they saw jobs leaving, trade deals they didn't like or understand, and they didn't see anybody paying a price for what set up the financial crash on Wall Street, therefore Trump. I mean, is that wrong in terms of that formulation, understanding how that happened?
I think there are some notable exceptions. I mean, I think the work Eric Steinerman has done with the banks is the right example. There's just not enough of it to break through to the American middle class that someone's looking out for us. But I think Ken's very astute. I think people, you know, as we advocate for very important policies, we need to do a better job making sure people see themselves. I mean, I think that's why the overtime rule is so important, because, yes, the minimum wage does need to go up, but there's folks working on a very small salary who make just above a minimum wage who don't see themselves in that class of workers anymore. That's why Bernie Sanders' proposal and others to pay for community college is so important. Community college for everybody, for working class people, for poor people, for teachers, for mailmen, for construction workers' kids. I went to RIT on a TAP grant, but TAP's only available to really, really poor people. So if my parents had been a construction worker or a union worker, I wouldn't have been eligible for that. So what we need to start talking about, things that are universal, that help everyone and give a lift, you know, a more lift up to poor people as well.
All right, before I jump back to a few more phone calls, Harold Meyerson's column had this item that I want to make sure we do hit because it's important. He wrote in the Washington Post the following, quote, "Legally, the most devastating blow to unions may come from the Supreme Court once a Trump-appointed conservative wins confirmation to the seat that the late Justice Scalia occupied. It was only Scalia's death that kept the court from ruling in the Friedrichs v. California Teachers Association case that public employee unions no longer have the right to collect partial dues payments from the non-members they represent in disputes with employers and for whom they bargain contracts," end quote. So Paul Hippolyte from the New York State United Teachers, he's a regional political organizer, you said this is a big one right now. What's the short version for, you know, sort of what this means and why it is so on the front burner right now?
So, like Carly was saying, Trump has given a lot of contradictory statements. So the correct answer is that we don't know, but we do know that Republicans control all houses of all branches of government right now. And if they get another Supreme Court justice, we don't know what that could mean. But I mean, there are things like the Wagner Act that we're nervous about. There are maybe they could defund the National Labor Relations Board. I mean, there are a lot of things that could happen as a result of a Trump presidency. So I guess as I said kind of earlier, though, I think that a lot of Trump's pickups in terms of some union workers was on the fact that he said he was going to protect the workers and that the workers love him. And you'll hear him say, I have all these steel workers here or whoever it is at his rallies. So I think that if those voters see this as a betrayal of their interests and of those real pocketbook issues, I think that's where we'll see how things change. But this is a huge decision.
All right. Beth Cordella from Polano and Farrow, can you help frame up what this will mean going forward in terms of, well, I guess it's, again, the case is, it's Friedrichs versus California Teachers Association, right. But it's about, you know, collection of dues payments, who's collecting, who's allowed to collect, and
right.
not. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Right. So, and this varies by state and by collective bargaining agreement, but in many states, not all of them, and especially in the public union context, you can always opt to not be in a union, but in many states and workplaces, you have to pay what's called an agency shop fee, or you know you have to pay some fee to the union because you are getting the benefit of their negotiating, even if you don't want to be a member. So you still get the wages, the benefits, the time off, all of these things that they've worked so hard, and they justify it by saying, you know, there are a lot of costs to this, and you should share in that cost. You shouldn't have what's called a free ride. The teachers that challenge this are saying this is a violation of my First Amendment rights. Unions are some of the largest political supporters and contributors to the Democrats. I'm not a Democrat. I don't agree. I don't agree with the social issues that the union takes. I don't agree with them, and by my funding them, I am being forced to support their speech.
De facto
speech.
Supporting
yes.
them. Okay. So
this
don't
is
want
going to come up again. As you said, Scalia died, and so the vote was 4-4. So the Ninth Circuit's ruling was upheld. I don't know if this particular case will get refiled, but there are dozens of cases just like it milling around in the federal courts, and it's bound to get picked up again by the Supreme Court because it's such a hot topic, and it's looking like now that a conservative justice will be appointed to the Supreme Court.
Right, so. And Jesse, what's the 30-second version for what the result will be for workers then?
I mean, look, I think you can look at unions like the postal workers who are already currently under open what we call open shop, meaning they don't have to pay or be members. And they have some of the highest union membership there is, 95-97%. So I think this what will result is unions will have to have an additional conversation with the people they are forced to represent by law and pay for it, whether they pay dues or not. And we'll sign those folks up. I mean, I think it will be time better spent advocating for better laws. But if the laws change, that's what unions will have to do, and they'll have to make sure people understand why they're paying dues.
All right, I've got 30 seconds for Carol in Rochester. Go ahead, Carol.
I was at a museum conference about 6 weeks ago. I'm president of a small house museum. We only have two employees. They talked about this Fair Labor Practices Act. And one executive director, one part-time office manager, and this Practices Act could negatively affect our bottom line. We're pretty much borderline on this threshold right now, but one of our options would be to raise the salary of our executive director so that we wouldn't have to pay overtime. And the thing that we've been doing is giving her a very generous bonus. Is that legal?
So I'll answer that. And this is the nonprofits are the ones. There's no carve outs for this minimum salary threshold raise for nonprofits, and it's many of them were lamenting that it would just kill them because they're working with little means with a small workforce. If the current federal regulations do end up going through, bonuses can account for 10% of the salary raise, provided that they are mandatory and paid on at least a quarterly basis.
Okay, so but her question on is it legal?
Is what legal?
Well, I mean, I guess the scenario she's describing, we're going to have more questions like this going
right.
forward.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, You have to either pay the minimum salary required by law, or you can pay 10% less of that and then make up the difference in bonuses.
Well, this just demonstrates again that there are so many questions hanging in the air, and it just I keep going back to the gospel of Jesse Lenny, which is elections have consequences. And this is going to be very interesting. Jesse Lenny from the Working Families Party. It's always nice talking to you. And I do think, is it fair to say you at least see this as an opportunity to understand what's happened and continue to move toward the American worker in terms of policy?
Jemima Williams said yesterday at a conference that even the darkest hours are the times you can see the stars the brightest. So, yes, there is always opportunity in crisis.
How poetic.
I love it. I mean, you meet Jesse Lenny.
That's stolen. It's the last time I give anybody credit. I'm taking it.
Thank you, Jesse. Paul Hippolyte from NYSA. Thank you, Paul. Carly Fox, Worker Justice Center. Thank you, Carly.
Seven.
And Beth Cordella from Polano & Farrow. Thank you, Beth.
Thank you.
All right, short break. More connections next.